beam cut into the lifter and tore it apart. There was no chance for anyone aboard to escape. I was sure of that. Harris, Leeson, and whoever else was still aboard, they were all dead. Natasha and I got separated in the confusion. I knew as I crouched in the water, pushing away rockfish that kept yawning, trying to get a grip on my armor, that Leeson was going to be mighty upset when he was revived. Nothing made a man feel more like a loser than dying twice in the same day. Chapter 21. Good thing we put the revival unit out of the ship when we did, I said to Carlos when he came staggering back to camp after his revival. He was still dripping wet. He reached for his armor with numb fingers. I helped him with the leggings. That was always the worst part when a man was fresh from a revive. Your balance was one of the last things to start working right. The bio people said it was due to the excess liquids inside the sinuses, which clogged the inner ear. It took a while to drain out and clear our heads.
No, it isn't, Carlos complained. If the cohort's revival unit had been destroyed, I could have been revived in another valley, one where I wasn't up to my ass in space squids.
I chuckled. Most of them seem to be some kind of genetically altered mega-humans, I pointed out.
Is that supposed to make me feel better?
Carlos demanded, leaning on me heavily.
And how come you're looking so smug?
What did you want? I asked him. A kiss on top of your head? Carlos was quite a bit shorter than I was, and he always hated it whenever I brought up this obvious comparison.
That's all you've got? Carlos demanded. Smart-ass remarks? I died at your hands again. And I didn't even get an apology? Nothing? Zip? Some friend you are.
I didn't fire that big beam, I told him somewhat defensively. The squids blew you up, not me. I'd been getting accusations like this all afternoon. The platoon was looking at me like I'd personally executed them. I knew it was partly because I'd survived and they hadn't. The guys who got lucky and lived through a bad fight always seemed like dirty, lucky pricks to the ones who died.
You might as well have blown up the lifter, Carlos retorted. Yeah, yeah, I know. They attacked us first. But I heard about what you did.
I eyed him coolly, trying to hide my concern. If Carlos knew that I'd shot down that enemy aircraft, well, I might as well broadcast vid of the event to the entire Legion. There were many things Carlos was capable of, but keeping his big mouth shut wasn't one of them.
What are you talking about? I asked. Don't play dumb with me, you freckle-faced cracker, he said. The role of village idiot suits you, but it doesn't fool me. I know you talked to that crazy little chick with the crossbow. That's treason right there, did you know that? You arranged some kind of alliance with her, didn't you? And now all of a sudden the aliens are shooting at us. What a surprise. Before, they'd been content to play slave driver with the colonists. But no, you had to go and mess that up and drag us into this crap stew.
I stopped listening to his tirade around then. Carlos kept complaining, but I didn't hear a word of it as I helped him into his armor. He was right, of course. But if he didn't know how I'd pulled it off, it didn't really matter. Suspicion wasn't in the same league as evidence. Internally, I breathed a sigh of relief. Natasha seemed to be the only one who knew the full story. She'd seen me shoot the alien aircraft personally, but I was pretty sure she would keep quiet. After all, we already had a few secrets between us. Carlos finally shut up when I put his helmet on. He lifted the visor and stared at me.
You aren't even listening, are you?
He asked.
Nope. I totally hate you.
I kind of figured. Close your faceplate. The enemy is using gas. Grumbling, he did as I suggested. We got moving then, as Leeson was calling on his able-bodied people to assemble. We were to advance and recon the enemy ship. Carlos wasn't happy about these orders. No one was.
This is just total bullshit, he kept saying as we pressed our way through the thick, waxy leaves.
We ran into a patch of different vegetation every now and then, stuff that looked like chard or spinach, but which was as tall as a man.
We could make a nice salad with all this greenery,
I commented.
Be my guest and eat some of it, McGill. I double-dog dare you.
I chuckled and kept moving forward. Leeson wasn't happy with me either. He'd put me on recon and given me a 3-man team. Naturally, the adjunct let the rest of his troops fall behind and linger. With me were only Carlos, Keevy, and Hudson. None of them were smiling when they realized the four of us were getting close to the enemy ship alone. Finally, Carlos kicked me in the ass. I turned around, my servos whirring. I straight-armed him, and he almost fell down.
You left a gouge in my armor, I complained.
It was an accident, Specialist.
We glared at each other for a second. Keevy and Hudson caught up, and Keevy rolled her eyes.
You boys going to fight again?
Keevy asked.
Don't be pussies this time. Use force blades. You might both die that way.
Carlos stopped glaring at me long enough to look at her.
Both of us, huh?
He asked her.
Aren't you pissed at McGill? He got you killed along with the rest of us, and don't pretend you don't know it.
Hudson took a step forward, but before he could speak, I lifted a hand to silence the group. I was only a specialist, but I outranked all of them. They paused to look at me. I could tell morale was low. That wasn't unusual in Legion Varus, but I didn't like being the cause of it.
Look, I said, we've had a bad day, but we're marching in the right direction now. We're going to kill these squids and their pet freaks, not colonists from Earth.
That was your plan, wasn't it?
Asked Carlos, squinting at me.
I see it all now. You're not just having fun. You're on a crusade. Well, count me out. I don't want to be involved with another of your lost causes.
You sure? I asked him. I've seen the colonist girls, you know. They're pretty hot. They'll be grateful if we save them and all. Carlos chewed on that one. I knew he'd been having fantasies about innocent colonists all the way out here in Corvus.
They don't seem very friendly, he said.
Let's find out. I turned and kept marching. The rest fell behind me. They were still grumbling, but at least no one was kicking me in the butt. I hoped we'd pull together before we made contact with the enemy. My hopes were dashed when we reached the top of a rise and bellied up to have a look. I could see the ship, and at this close range, the shimmering shields were visible to the naked eye. The shields looked like a shell of rain that fell endlessly over the ship, but never touched it.
Turn on your suits and transmit,
I said quietly. I needn't have bothered. Everyone was working their tappers, taking stills and transmitting vids. Something strange loomed up among the thick foliage directly to the east of us. It wasn't anything I'd seen before. Impossibly tall, thin, and man-like, the creature had dangling limbs with oversized hands and feet. Naked, except for a flap of leathery cloth wound around its narrow midsection, it had no weapons that we could see. The face was even odder than the body. Nostrils, the size of credit pieces, quivered in a nose that was as large and protruding as a normal man's elbow. Red-rimmed eyes like coals stared at us over that nose. I think it was a surprise to find us as we were to meet it. When it first appeared, it had been walking on all fours, but it reared up when it encountered us, standing a dozen feet tall. Keevy's force blades sizzled into life extending from her wrists. I lifted my tube, but a huge hand lashed out and smashed it down. The creature was skinny, but strong. The plasma tube went whirling away. Keevy struck at that arm quick as a snake. The oversized hand flew free with a spray of dark blood, which splashed the foliage with a sound like falling raindrops. The creature galloped back from us, scrambling and using its stump as well as its other three limbs. I went for my plasma cannon, but never managed to reach it. An intense beam leapt out from the direction of the alien ship. It slagged my cannon and then swept toward me, melting earth and withering the giant flowers. I raced back toward cover. I turned my head to see how the fight with the tall, skinny freak had gone. Instantly, I knew all was not well for him. The cannon had shot the freak down, and he'd been left quivering, slumped on the ground. I felt a pang of sorrow for him. He hadn't seemed too bright. He'd been enslaved since birth, I felt sure of that, and the aliens in that ship didn't seem to give a damn if he lived or died. My recon group ran farther into the brush. Whooshing, crackling sounds ripped through the plants over our ducked heads, setting fire to the crowns of 100 flowers with blossoms the size of umbrellas. When we found a shallow depression and hunkered down inside it, Keevy spoke first.
"What was that thing?"
"Some kind of specially bred human," I said.
"Bred for what?" asked Carlos. "Reaching the top shelf?"
"I don't know, but it was sniffing around. Maybe it was patrolling the area for stray humans. They're here to collect slaves, remember?"
"Yeah," Carlos said thoughtfully.
"Yeah, that's it. He's like some kind of skinny tracking hound. He's a slaver who runs people down after sniffing them out. I can see how that would be useful when they're trying to dig people out of their caves."
"A slaver," I said thoughtfully. "As good a name as any." Carlos seemed to puff up with pride. He liked naming things and took credit for such honors, whether he deserved it or not. The beams from the ship soon stopped coming. We reported in via our suit radios, and it wasn't 30 seconds later that the enemy found us again. I think it was our transmissions that had screwed us. We'd forgotten these weren't low-tech lizards in a forest. Whatever they were, these squids knew their tech. This time there were 6 slavers, not just one. They carried nets that crackled and sparked in gloved hands. With an odd, croaking series of cries, they sprang up all around us. I wouldn't have thought such large creatures could move with such stealth. I swore later, as did the rest of my team, that they hadn't made a sound or disturbed a single leaf. The nets launched, spread, and floated down toward us. Electricity flowed in each metallic thread. I could see the nets spark and flash, arcing with everything they touched. The nets floated down slowly, as if they were made of feather-like material. The look on the faces of the slavers was one of triumph. They seemed certain of victory. I guess that's because they'd never fought with armored humans before. A group bearing crossbows and wearing leathers like the colonists would surely have been in serious trouble. My team circled up, and we put our backs together. Carlos used his laser, beaming away at the face of the one nearest him. The eyes smoked, and the man-thing fell back, screeching and clawing at his face. Hudson and Keevy followed his example by trying to burn the other slavers. But they'd been warned and hunkered back, hiding behind the fronds and stems of nearby plants. The lasers still found them and burned smoldering streaks across their leathery chests. But they lived, even if they were left screaming and thrashing. I didn't have my cannon, so I went with force blades. Looking back, I realized this was the right choice, and probably saved my life. I directed the beams upward and squeezed my gauntlets, depressing the studs in the palms. Twin blades shot upward, and I kept squeezing, reaching for maximum extension. I'd realized that these guys were tall, and I had to have as much reach as I could get to fight them on even footing. Before I could thrust my blades into the slavers that encircled us, I heard a screech, a human sound. I glanced to my left and saw Keevy sink to her knees. One of those falling gossamer nets had touched her armor, and she collapsed under it, paralyzed. Without even looking up, I slashed over my head with my force blades. They crackled and snapped as they cut through the strange fibers of the net that had almost reached me. The slaver in front of me plucked his shredded net in confusion. I'm sure he'd never seen a man defeat it before. His overly long fingers reached out, but he didn't get them back. I cropped all of them from his hand with a smooth slashing motion using my left blade. Then I cocked the left blade over my head to act as a guard. The right blade I thrust with, and its length pierced that skinny stack of ribs, opening up the slaver and spilling his organs over the mud. Twitching the tip upward, I ended his life, and he collapsed in a shivering, bony mass. 2 pairs of hands gripped me from behind a moment later. As I was dispatching the slaver close to me, the others had leapt and grabbed me from behind. They warbled and hooted in excitement. I felt my body lift from the ground. I had a hand as big as a basketball blocking my vision almost completely, as it had been placed over my faceplate. More hands had me under the arms of my armored suit, and with a grunt they lifted me. I was amazed they could manage it. They were strong, like apes, with muscles that jumped and rippled under their stretched skins. More hands had each of my wrists, holding them out so I couldn't cut them with my force blades. I struggled, but a second later I was lifted like a child by a kidnapper. I realized I was aloft and bouncing. They'd lifted me up and were carrying me away toward their ship, no doubt. Visions of slavery on a strange world sprang up in my mind. I quelled panic. I had to keep myself in as cool a frame of mind as I could. I wanted to shout and call for help, but I resisted the urge. The recon team was too far from the rest of the platoon. No one was going to come to my aid in time. As calmly as I could, under the circumstances, I radioed Leeson and reported my situation.
"Sir, we've been overrun. We killed two tall, skinny guys, but I'm the only man left conscious."
"What are you saying, McGill? Where's the rest of the team? I'm only seeing your suit on my display."
Squeezing my gauntlets, I shortened the force blades. As it was, they'd been cutting through the forest of growths like twin scythes. I figured I might as well save power.
"Sir, they've been captured in some kind of metallic netting. Maybe it interferes with radio contact. We're all being carried to the ship. We've been captured, sir, all of us."
"What? By a bunch of naked freaks? Kill them and free yourself. That's an order, McGill."
I rolled my eyes as the channel closed. I tried to think, but it was difficult. There had to be something I could do. They were smarter than I'd assumed, and when they got me to their ship, I was pretty sure they'd dismantle my suit and pull me out of it as a man might rip an oyster from its shell. In the meantime, the slavers weren't idle. They must have noticed my force blades had withdrawn. They forced my arms upward, and I strained against them, but not too strongly. I didn't want them to know just how powerful my exoskeleton could be if I diverted all power to the enhancement systems. That was a mistake on my part, because they touched my wrists together, and I heard a loud, metallic click. The huge hand that had been over my visor retreated. I was able to see my situation clearly. My wrists each had a circle of metal around them, two black rings that touched one another. I tugged, but my wrists would not come apart. I recalled then what Della had told me. "They will place rings around your arms and touch them together. Then you will never be able to separate your hands from one another again until they will it." I stared at those rings around my wrists for a long second, then cranked my neck around. We were heading toward the ship just as I thought. I saw Keevy, Hudson, and Carlos were all netted and being dragged behind the other slavers. My comrades appeared to be helpless, paralyzed by the effect of the nets. I wondered then if my first command was going to go down in Legion Varus history with a footnote declaring it a record-breaking failure. We made a sorry showing. We'd only killed two of our attackers, and they captured my entire team. As the only man who could still act, I was determined to put up more of a fight. The first thing I did was relax. I let the slavers transfer me to one of their group, who carried me on his back at a loping run toward the lowered ramp. Being carried like captive prey by tall, skinny guys that were twice my height had to be the oddest ride I'd ever experienced. I felt like a little kid, something I wasn't at all used to. We reached the force shields that encircled the ship. I felt the screens tingle against my skin as we passed through them. The slavers were forced to slow down and edge their way through. As we pressed into the shimmering zone of stilled molecules, I felt a chill pass through me, which was a side effect of shielding. The slaver carrying me on his back made a mistake then. He let go of my clasped wrist. His huge palm, a webbing of bones and skin, reached up to press against the screens. It was a natural enough thing to do. People normally tried to push away the screens, as they felt odd against the face like a mass of breaking cobwebs. Putting out your hand to brush them away never helped end the sensation, but people did it all the time anyway. Biding my time, I waited until the very moment we passed through the shielding. Force blades didn't operate properly inside a shield wall. Once we were through, the slaver's hand came for my wrists again. I grinned inside my helmet. I squeezed my fingers closed inside my right gauntlet, and a shimmering line of force sprouted like a unicorn horn out of it. The slaver must have known what was coming. His red eyes widened, and I thought I heard a croak of dismay. I thrust my short, thick blade home. The slaver crumpled, his legs going limp, and I crashed down 5 feet or more to the hard ground. I grunted, rolled onto all fours, and struggled to my feet. Ahead of me, Keevy, Hudson, and Carlos were all being dragged away. I reached for my sidearm, but it was gone. The slavers had been bright enough to disarm me. Glancing toward the shield that shot up into a high dome at my back, it occurred to me that I should be slipping back through it and running for the forest. Don't think for a moment that this thought didn't impinge strongly. It did. But standing against my desire for self-preservation was concern for my teammates, who were even now being carted toward that strange, looming ship. I stared after the slavers, watching my friends bang against their legs in sacks of metallic webbing. What would happen to Keevy, to Carlos? I didn't know Hudson that well, but I knew he didn't deserve this fate. The key problem was that they couldn't be revived if they were captured. One of the chief nightmares of any legionnaire was exactly this situation. There were few fates worse than being held captive and incognito on an alien world. Without a confirmed death, the Legion couldn't legally revive you. Probably a good thing, in my estimation. Who'd want to try to live a normal life knowing that you had a copy of yourself screaming in a cell light years away, circling a distant star? Ah, crap, I muttered, and started after the trio of slavers. I cranked my exoskeleton to full power and diverted most of it to my legs. With leaps and bounds, I raced after them. They spotted me before I reached the ramp. The slavers were at the foot of the vast tongue of metal. Just the ramp by itself was impressive. It had looked small at a distance, but up close I realized it was huge, the size of a basketball court, at least. Above that tongue was a black mouth that yawned open. There was darkness inside, punctuated by brilliant points of white light. I didn't know what they had in there, and right now I didn't want to know. I concentrated on one thing, getting to my friends before they were dragged into that ship and forgotten forever. Very aware of my situation, I saw the big gun on top of the ship catch sight of me. Like a bird of prey, it tracked and swiveled. Could it have nothing better than to burn little old me? To give it something to worry about, I ran into a pile of crated equipment. The operators would have to make a decision. Was a single man worth damaging their stockpile? The gun kept tracking me right up to the point where I set foot on the ramp. It never fired, and at that point shifted away toward more distant enemies. I didn't have time to breathe a sigh of relief, however. In front of me, the three slavers turned around. They looked surprised to see me sprinting after them, even amused. Behind me, a squad of 9 litter mates who'd been standing in a perfect square like switched-off robots suddenly came to life. They turned together and approached. I imagined that someone in the ship had activated the squad to deal with the lone human inside their perimeter. It didn't take a genius to realize I was trapped and screwed. The 9 in my rear shouldered huge rifles, but the slavers lifted hands and chittered at them, waving them back. They must have been happy to see a new captive who seemed intent on delivering himself into their vast hands. The trio dropped my friends like sacks of meal. They stepped apart, moving to flank me. This was it, I realized. It was time to do and to die. Moments like this come to Legion troops more often than old Earth armies. Knowing you're going to come back to life after a fight changes a man's calculations. Sure, plenty of times in history, men have made the decision to go down fighting, to take as many of the enemy with them as they could. But with foreknowledge of resurrection, I think we were a little more likely to choose such a path. Legionnaires didn't fall to their knees and beg for mercy from alien foes. We didn't embrace capture as a way out. Instead, we feared it as one of the worst possible fates. Knowing I was about to die freed up my mind and my body. I wasn't afraid anymore. Not exactly. I was intent on doing damage as much as I could before they brought me down. The slavers didn't know any of this, naturally. They knew I could fight. They knew I was dangerous. But they couldn't know they had a suicidal maniac charging toward them. I veered left, letting the center man maneuver to circle behind me. The man on the far right huffed and ran forward, not wanting to be left out of the capture. "Take down one at a time," Veteran Harris had always said. "The other guys can wait. Finish your target and move on only after you're sure the first one is in the bag." To my pleasure, I noticed a hint of doubt in the expression on my targeted slaver's ugly face. The tall, skinny monster on the left side of the ramp didn't look as happy as the other two. Still, he postured himself gamely enough. His knobby knees flexed and bent. His arms flew wide, impossibly wide. He had a wingspan that would have made a condor jealous. Instead of extending two force blades, I extended only one. After all, my wrists were still clamped together. I couldn't work two weapons effectively if I couldn't move my arms independently. I slowed down in the final moments of my charge. I leveled one long blade like a lance. Shimmers of dusky orange, magenta, and neon green ran the length of the blade like electric flames. The colors reached the tip, then chased themselves back again to my gauntlet. Thrusting for the slaver's midsection, I was surprised by his agility. He bounced backward, squirming in the air. I thrust and missed him again, while he retreated farther. His strategy was immediately clear to me. The other two were circling and closing in. They'd pull me down from behind just as they'd done before. With a snarl of frustration, I shifted right toward my three helpless comrades. The slaver I'd been stabbing at gargled something in his throat and advanced to follow me. That was the move I'd been waiting for. I whirled back and thrust for him again. But this time I stabbed downward, lancing his foot. I pinned it for a brief second to the ramp itself. He struggled with a cry of pain and pulled away the smoking remnants of his injured foot. My blade flicked upward again, and this time he couldn't dodge and hop away. I gutted him and left him flopping on the ramp. I turned with barely a second to spare. The center man, who'd been coming up behind me, closed his massive hands. His fingers enveloped each of my arms. It was a losing strategy for him. Force blades don't get pinned. They may take a few seconds to burn through a tough substance, but they always go through in the end. I cut the second man in half from crotch to skull. Those big hands that gripped me fell away as lifeless as dead autumn leaves. The third man and final slaver lost heart then. He pointed at me and turned toward the nine that stood in perfect formation at the foot of the ramp. He was obviously declaring me persona non grata. I couldn't blame him for that. The front rank of the nine dropped to the ground. The second rank went down to one knee, and the three in the back stood tall. Once in position, they lifted their rifles and sighted in unison. I hadn't waited around while they created their own miniature firing squad. I ignored the last slaver and ran to my three friends. My force blade sank first into Kiwi. It was a hard thing to do, let me tell you. I've slept with Kiwi, and I've fought with her and died at her side. To kill her, to drive my lance into her back while she lay there helpless and paralyzed, I never wanted to do it again. Three quick strides brought me to Carlos next. He was lying in a different pose. His face plate was open and his brown eyes stared up at me. Even though he was watching, I found it a little easier to kill him. Don't ask me why. The first volley caught me then, knocking me from my feet and tossing me ass over tea kettle right up the ramp. I was broken, and my armor had at least four smoking holes punched into it. I'd taken nine massive slugs, but I struggled to my knees and approached Hudson, the last of the captives. I can't tell you how much pain I was in. I'm not really sure anyone can when they're already dead but still moving. My body was functioning to some extent, not having shut down completely yet, but for the most part I was numb. The last slaver made whooping noises. I'm not really sure if he was cheering on the gunners or impressed by my performance or just happy to be alive. Crawling, I reached Hudson. But I didn't get my blade into him. I tried. Oh, Lord, how I tried. but my body just wouldn't obey me anymore. I rolled onto my back, going limp. The sky above was lit by the harsh light of Zeta Herculis, and there was no beauty in the sight for me. A weight fell upon my wrists then, a vast, impossible weight. I saw with fading consciousness that the last slaver had come and placed his foot upon my wrists to keep me from cutting him. Cautiously, curiously, his face loomed over mine. He asked me a question then, something in his strange, warped tongue. I didn't understand it, but I knew that I'd intrigued him. He looked into my dying eyes with a squinting, uncomprehending gaze.
"Maybe," I rasped, "I'll get a chance to explain things to you later on, freak."
And then I died. Chapter 22. The next thing I knew, I was lying on my back in a bunker that the Legion had dug in the midst of a stack of boulders. The bunker gave people a chance to recuperate after revival, but I knew its critical function was to protect the revival machine itself. Nearby, the revival team worked feverishly to revive everyone who'd been lost on this very long day.
"Are you insane?"
demanded Carlos. He was standing over me, glaring down at my naked body on a makeshift cot. I blinked, barely able to process his anger. I barely knew who I was yet, but memories were drifting back to me. Dying and coming back to life was kind of like waking up suddenly in the middle of a dream. Sometimes you weren't quite sure how to sort through the stuff that had actually happened and the stuff that was only ghostly echoes inside your head.
"You're saying you killed me so I wouldn't be captured?" Carlos asked after I'd explained my decision to him. "That's just unreal. I don't buy it, not for a second, McGill. You're either full of shit or certifiable, maybe both."
"Of course that's why he did it," Kiwi said.
She was sitting on a rock nearby dressing herself. Ann Grant, overworked and haggard, waved at the two of them irritably.
"Take McGill out of here. He's a good grow. Get him dressed and out of my bunker."
"Kicking us out already?" Carlos asked. "I thought you were sweet on him. At least that's what he says."
Ann growled at him and pointed toward the exit. I followed her gesture, and a white square of light hurt my freshly grown eyes. It was strange to think these eyes had never experienced sunlight before. A few moments later, I stumbled out into the open with Carlos and Kiwi on either side of me propping me up.
"I was hoping you'd come out with a bad grow," Carlos complained. "I was going to volunteer for the grim but very necessary duty of recycling you, you murdering sack."
Getting tired of him faster than usual, I shook his hands off my elbow.
"I had to kill you," I said, slurring my words slightly. "I had to. And my only regret was that I didn't get to poor Hudson fast enough." "I still don't buy it," Carlos said. "You forget, McGill, I saw your face. I was looking right up, and I saw a bloodthirsty leer as you drove that force blade through me. I felt it, too. We were paralyzed, but I could still see and feel everything."
I frowned. "Sorry about that."
"You enjoyed it, didn't you? Some little part of you has always wanted to kill me. You saw your chance with an excuse all lined up, and you went for it. I saw your eyes."
"I don't remember," I lied.
"Bastard."
Kiwi put her head against my shoulder.
"Well," she said, "I'm glad you did it, James. What if that ship takes off right now? What if everybody aboard is hauled away, never to be seen again? They'll be captives forever in some vile prison, warped into those monsters that have been bred from human flesh. I don't want to be forced to have children and to watch them grow into genetically modified slaves."
"You're welcome," I told her. Carlos made a farting sound with his mouth and stomped away. I didn't care. I knew he'd get over it eventually. He always did. He knew I'd done the right thing. He was just upset that it had to happen at all. Carlos always had to blame someone when things went badly, anyone other than himself. He was a good enough friend when you really needed one, but I hoped he never made it into the officer ranks. I liked Kiwi's reaction much better. She gave me a little kiss and helped me into a fresh suit of armor, talking as she did. I learned we'd been ordered to report to Graves himself the second our bodies were operating normally. To my surprise, the first thing Graves did was order us back to the bunker with the revival machine. We'd been tasked with escorting the machine and its operating staff on a circuitous route around the lake. Fortunately, we didn't have to carry the thing by hand. It weighed over a ton, and even with our suits, it wouldn't have been easy. We were provided two drone marchers, which up until now had been kept in reserve. Most of the drones were in other valleys assigned to other cohorts. These two, however, had been aboard our lifter from the start. They'd been used to transport the revival machine off the lifter, and had thus been spared when the ship blew up. I marched with the rest of the revived group ahead of Centurion Graves and the bio people. We took the long way around the central lake so as to avoid the alien ship on the other side. The drones were four-legged machines that resembled thick-legged pigs. We called them pigs, or piggies. They had a barrel-like central torso, four heavy legs, and no head at all. They navigated with a mix of input from high-frequency sonar and scanning cameras in cages along the sides. Once in a while, I heard a little singing sound, which I knew was the sonar. But for the most part, I had to listen to their engines and those churning legs, which put up quite a racket. We were all glad to have the piggies with us, even if they were kind of noisy. They carried the revival machine strung up between them like it was no big deal. The only clue they gave concerning the tremendous weight they were bearing was the depth of their footprints. The pads on the bottom of their feet were about as big around as that of an average elephant, but they sunk into the soft ground anyway. When the drones pulled those feet back up and out, there was a terrific squelching noise. About 2 hours after marching through the odd growths on the west side of the lake, we were within sight of the rest of the cohort. They'd taken the time to build up a small fortification, Puffcrete, mostly hidden behind a ridge in the landscape. From here, they couldn't be hit by direct beams from the ship. For their part, the aliens had stopped coming after Legion Varus. When we'd retreated from the area of their ship, they seemed to lose interest. They were now scouring the cliffs again, searching for captives among the colonists. Reaching picket lines posted in the forest, we identified ourselves and were hustled through to the main camp. The piggies picked up pace, almost as if they knew they'd be allowed to rest soon. The camp was on full alert. I could tell the cohort hadn't been idle. They'd been digging and building. Puffcrete bunkers were everywhere, buried in the soft, dark soil around the lake. We delivered the revival unit and a team of bio people took over. They hustled and heaved, carting the machine down into the black, gaping mouth of a bunker they'd built specifically for this purpose. To me, they looked like ants dragging a kill down their hole to be consumed. Afterward, we formed up with the rest of our unit. I felt relieved. I'd never liked being off on my own with just Leeson and a few troops defending the lifter. Now that the lifter had been destroyed, the commanders had decided we'd all be better off here in one central encampment which couldn't be hit by the enemy's big cannon. I wasn't so sure about that, but I was happy not to be in a smaller group.
"McGill,"
Graves said, waving me to come closer the moment he saw me. I stumped over, and he eyed me critically.
"You're one crazy son of a bitch,"
he said without humor or anger.
"I heard about what you did right there on the doorstep."
Thank you, Centurion. He snorted.
"It wasn't meant as a compliment. You killed your own men after killing most of the skinnies that caught you. Did I get that right?"
"Skinnies? You must be talking about those tall, freaky-looking guys, right? We've been calling them slavers. They seem to specialize in capturing humans. They can sniff us out wherever we hide."
"Skinnies, slavers, whatever. Nasty freaks, no matter what you call them. But let's get back to the part about killing your own team, shall we? That's not exactly in our standard playbook. You know that, right?
Yes, sir. I'm aware that I didn't follow regs, but I wanted my people to be revived and to come back into the fight. If we'd all been dragged aboard that ship, we might have been transported into space and end up on another planet indefinitely.
So, no regrets on your part?
He asked, narrowing his eyes. On the contrary, I said. I have plenty of regrets. I wish I had killed all the skinnies right off. That would have been a much better outcome. And sometimes I wish I'd signed with a different legion, a legion that doesn't specialize in such deadly missions. Graves rewarded me with a rare, rumbling laugh.
Such a bullshitter. I'm talking about killing your own team. No regrets there?
That? No, sir. They're happy with the outcome, too. Just ask them. My only regret in that regard is that I didn't make it to Hudson in time to finish him along with the rest. I can't imagine what the aliens are doing to him even now inside the guts of that ship. Graves' eyes drifted toward the vessel in the east. We couldn't see it directly, as the ridge was in the way. But we all knew it was there. It didn't take much imagination to think of Hudson shivering and miserable in some cage, trapped within that vast ship. Graves turned back to me and clapped me on the shoulder. The metal of his gauntlet rang against my epaulette.
"That's what I wanted to hear," he said. "No regrets. Well done, McGill. In my opinion, you made the right call. But I'll have to edit your after-action report slightly, just in case the brass gets nosy."
He walked away, and I frowned after him. Edit the report? Did he think that anyone higher ranked than he was going to read it? I hadn't even considered the notion. But then I hadn't been thinking about Primus Turov. She was always looking for a good reason to take a shot at me. I'd thwarted her plans a year back, and she wasn't the forgiving type. Shrugging, I went back to my platoon and met with Leeson. He looked me over as if he didn't quite know what to make of me. After he gave us a briefing on the planned morning action, which involved attacking the slavers as they searched the caves for colonists, he beckoned to me. I moved to his side, and he stood with his back to the others so no one could listen in.
"I don't want you thinking you could pull that kind of shit whenever you want, McGill," he told me in a hushed tone.
"What specific variety of shit are we talking about, sir?"
He glared at me. "You know damn well what I'm talking about. Don't think for a second you can get away with driving a force blade into my throat and walking away a hero afterward. I'll erase you when I get revived. That's a promise. Legion Varus won't even have a record of your existence by the end of the next day."
"Don't worry. If these freaks manage to get their gentle hands wrapped around you, well, sir, as far as I'm concerned, they can keep you." I smiled and walked away. I could feel Leeson's eyes burning into my back, but I didn't care. That night, I slept with Keevy. Killing a girl had to be the weirdest way to turn her on that I'd ever heard of, but it had worked out for me this time. I doubted anyone else had ever tried it, and I sincerely hoped never to experience such a situation again. The sex was great, don't get me wrong. Of all the girls I'd been with in Legion Varus, she was the most intense, and probably the most experienced. I'm not sure what it is about the nearness of death that causes the human brain to turn to quick, intimate contact. But the effect is undeniable. We were alive again after having died so utterly, so helplessly. The reprieve, the second chance, it seemed to kick over something in our minds. We wanted to live life to the fullest and didn't hold anything back. In the depths of the night, which was several hours longer than I was accustomed to, I heard a stealthy sound. One would think that I would have slept right through it. After all, going through a revival and enjoying Keevy's companionship in my tent had pretty much worn me out. But some part of me lit up, and I awakened anyway. Sucking in a gulp of air and sitting up suddenly, I groped in the darkness. I found a wrist and clamped onto it with my hand. The wrist was a thin one, but it tried to pull away with surprising strength. I held on, and my bleary eyes adjusted.
"Della?"
I asked in a whisper.
"Let go of me," she hissed back.
I have a blade.
I saw now that she did indeed have a weapon. It glimmered in the light coming from the vertical slit she'd carefully unzipped to let herself in.
What the hell are you doing in my tent? I asked. I came to talk to you.
I gave my head a shake to wake up and let her go. I glanced over Akivi. She was frowning and twitching in her sleep, but hadn't awakened. I could tell she was dreaming. Her eyelids were shifting. Then I noticed something else. A tiny, open vial lay near Kiwi's face. There was a dark red dust under her nose. It looked like cinnamon or chili powder.
What did you give to Kiwi? She's asleep. Come with me. Your mechanical birds will find us soon.
I frowned at her, but I followed her out of my tent. I was trying to wrap my mind around what was happening. How had Della gotten into our camp? We had drones, guards, and sensors. The techs were seriously screwing up, but I didn't buy the idea Della had sprinkled sleeping powder under everyone's nose. The answer came soon thereafter. She led me to a thicket of alien growths that looked like bulbous cacti. But these cacti had feathery leaves rather than spines. In the middle of these plants was a collection of boulders. One of them shifted at her touch. A dark opening stretched about a foot wide.
"Follow me," she said,
and began to slide into the opening. I looked dubiously into the crack in the earth. I walked up to it, crouched, and stared into the darkness. I couldn't see much, other than Della's shapely legs and butt disappearing into it. When she was gone, I grumbled to myself thoughtfully. Why me? I know that's the sort of question a fighting man should never ask himself, but I did it anyway. Della! I called down the hole. There was no answer. I was alone. There was no doubt in my mind about what I should do then. I should stand up, walk back to my tent, and call my unit commanders. Hell, I wasn't even wearing my heavy armor. Not that it would fit into that slit in the ground anyway. Doubting my sanity, I went back to my tent, grabbed a small ruck with a sidearm and a few supplies, and prepared to leave. I took the time to check Kiwi's pulse, which was strong, and to take the vial away from her face. I didn't want her to overdose on whatever that stuff was. As an afterthought, I stoppered the vial and put it into my ruck. One never knew when such a substance might come in handy. When I returned to the spot where Della had disappeared, I couldn't find the crack in the rocks. I cursed and shoved aside underbrush and dead leaves. It had to be here, right here. I found it, at last. Could it have narrowed even further? I slipped my fingers inside and pulled at it, stretching it wider. The hole was triangular, and it looked like a sliding section of rock. But it was clearly something fashioned to resemble rock. When it was wide enough, I shined a light inside. There wasn't much to see other than a narrow stone tunnel. A buzzard swooped by. I flicked off my light and stashed it in my bag. I sat next to the opening and yawned. Whoever was running that buzzard took a good long look at me. I wondered if it was Natasha herself. I pretended to be oblivious to the attention, and soon the buzzer wandered off. The best way to avoid surveillance, I've always found, is to be as boring as humanly possible. The second the buzzer left, I felt a sharp pain in the back of my leg. I gritted my teeth, holding back a shout. Standing up, I flipped my light back on and peered down into the hole again. There was Della's face staring up at me. I realized she jabbed me with something. But I wasn't dying. I figured it hadn't been a nanite-tipped weapon.
"Are you coming or not?"
she asked sharply. All I could see were her brown, almond-shaped eyes. There were streaks of dirt and sweat on her brow, but somehow she was still pretty, in a rustic sort of way.
"Yeah,"
I heard myself say. What happened next was hard to credit even to me, but I climbed down into that hole. I seriously doubted my mental capacities as I did it. I had to wonder if those psych tests they'd given me long ago back at the mustering hall had been right all along. Chapter 23. The tunnel slanted downward, then leveled off. As best I could tell, we were headed toward the nearest rocky cliffs, away from the lake. That was good as far as I was concerned. I didn't want to risk drowning under the lake and out of range of the Legion's sensors. The passage widened, narrowed, then turned wet and dank. We splashed through regions of still, oily water. "Where are we going?" I asked Della.
"To the verge,"
she said, as if that explained everything. I grumbled and kept after her. "Why did you come to me?"
"I don't trust any of your kind," she said. "But I can't deny that you're fighting the slavers. I saw you die on the ramp. That was a brave thing. Few warriors have ever defeated even a single slaver."
"You saw that? How?" Della glanced back over her shoulder, eyeing me with a calculating glance. There wasn't much in the way of a light source in the tunnels. The walls glimmered faintly, just enough to keep a man from ramming his nose into them. She carried a chemical light in the form of a tube around her neck, which illuminated her face from below, with a wan, yellow-green glow.
"We have tubes drilled through the walls of the cliffs," she told me. "There are lenses and mirrors inside. We can see most of the valley. Guiding wires allow us to direct our scopes and focus on distant objects. We installed the system to watch our enemies years ago. If you ever find one down here, be careful, however. They're dangerous when the ship fires light at the walls of stone. Your eyes will be burned from your head. My people are careful never to look through the tubes at the wrong times."
I nodded thoughtfully, and she turned and trotted away. I followed. The system of scopes and the network of tunnels I toured over the next 10 minutes were an impressive engineering effort. The tunnel system represented a low-tech solution and a clever use of resources. The colonists were admirable in their own way. They were determined and obviously tough survivors. I'd always thought we'd had it rough back on Earth over the last century or so. But compared to these people, Earthers like me lived in the lap of luxury. "Where the hell are we going, girl?" I asked after we must have jogged and slogged 20 minutes more. "Isn't this far enough for a private talk?" She halted and looked back at me, cocking her head in the same way she'd done the first time I talked to her.
"A private talk?"
she asked. "Yes. I'd been assuming you wanted to discuss our alliance, to talk about what we're going to do next. No one can hear us down here."
"I'm taking you to speak to the investigator," she said, as if this explained the situation with perfect clarity.
"The what?"
"Our leader, the principal, the one in charge of this valley."
"Oh, okay. What does he want?"
"I don't know, but I'm sure it will be important. You've decided upon your course of action, we understand that, but we've yet to decide ours."
That was all she would tell me. We spent 30 more minutes in the tunnels, during which time I became hopelessly lost. We jogged upward and downward, taking various forks, twists, and turns. I was trying to keep a mental map, but there were no landmarks to differentiate one tunnel from another. At one point, we passed a glimmer of light from outside. A pale circular beam played along the left wall. I stopped and searched the right wall for an aperture. When I finally found it, Della came back to see what I was doing. "I found one of your little spy glasses," I said, peering into a conical tube about the size of a water glass.
"Careful," she said. "You never know. When they might shine their great weapon, you'll be blinded."
Deciding to take the chance, I put my face to the cone and swiveled it. Pulleys squeaked and grit shifted. My field of view was limited, but I could see a slightly blurred, dusty version of the valley at night. Stars overhead played like pinpricks in a velvet blanket. To my left, the ship was visible only as a darker hull in a pit of umber. To my right, there were lights scattered over a circular region.
"That must be our camp. So far down.
I hadn't realized we'd climbed inside the cliff walls. We must be 200 meters up and a kilometer from the camp. We're right between both armies now."
"You see much for an untrained eye," she said.
We have devices like these, but they fly and carry cameras.
She nodded.
The intelligent insects. We know about them.
Tell me, Della, I said. What will the aliens do next? They must know we're going to fight them. Will they come at us? Or will they keep trying to capture you in your tunnels?
They'll do whatever they find to be the easiest. They only want slaves. If we make it too difficult and delay them long enough, they will eventually go away. That is our goal.
I nodded thoughtfully. Have you ever considered anything more drastic?
Her eyes narrowed.
You'll have to talk to the investigator about that.
She clammed up then, and I was left following in her wake. By the time we reached a large, open cavern, I figured we must be getting closer to the side of the valley where the ship was than my own side. The main cavern was a surprise. There had to be hundreds of people in it, maybe thousands. I couldn't see them all in the faint light. Unlike the dusty, crumbling holes I'd been traveling through, it was well kept and airy. There were exhaust ports in the roof. Could they be natural chimneys? Fresh air came in from someplace else. They even had a row of fires along one wall for cooking and the like. Along the far wall, up a series of ramps and stairways, was an area apart from the rest of the cavern. This upscale region was set upon a shelf of flat, fine marble. I could tell right off that was where the important folk spent their time. Instead of crude furniture built of sticks and canvas, there were real chairs, and even tables carved from polished stone. We passed people performing odd operations. There was something that looked like a forge, but not a primitive one. Men with goggles handled lead-shielded pots, pouring hot molten metals. My rad meters jumped on my tapper when we passed this operation, so I gave them a wide berth. Della led the way to the base of what appeared to be manufactured steps built with tubular steel. I frowned at them as I followed her to the top. "These steps," I said, pausing. I looked around, noticing the even, regular shape of the cavern. The walls were ribbed, in fact, with heavy curved supports. I looked at Della, and she eyed me quietly. "I think I've figured it out," I said. "This cave. This isn't a cave at all. It's what's left of Hydra, isn't it?" She stepped close to me.
"Pretend you don't know. People will not trust you with the knowledge."
"Right," I said, looking around. It was obvious now that I thought about it. Sure, it was dusty and decrepit. What must have been decks had been turned into open floors. "Looks like you guys cannibalized much of the ship to build stuff. You must have removed a lot of the metal, and where are the engines?" Della pursed her lips in annoyance. I don't think she was happy that I'd figured out their little secret.
"Hydra was a colony ship," she said. "The vessel was built to be dismantled and used to start our colony. But as I said, it's best you don't talk about it."
"Okay, I'll play dumb. You have to tell me one more thing, though. How did you bury it in solid rock?"
"When we found the system was occupied, we decided to hide ourselves here, in the wall of this valley. We used the engines to burn into a cliff and let the rock fall outside to cover the entry point."
I nodded thoughtfully. It was quite an engineering feat. My estimation of these people and their technical skills had risen another notch. It almost made me sad to think the Earthers had such amazing engineers before I was born. We hadn't done much of anything on our home world to advance ourselves for several generations. I guess that was part of the grand design of the Empire, to prevent frontier worlds like ours from creating new technology and eventually becoming a threat to the core systems. Following Della, I found I was in for a further surprise. I'd been expecting a scene of wealth, at least compared to the lower-class folks who lived on the ship's belly and outer hull. But although I did see better materials and living conditions on the upper deck, I was struck by the number of scientific instruments they had as well. There was a region of batteries fed by clattering generators. Past that, following the black and red wires,
We reached a wide variety of machines. There were computers, medical equipment, and even a full machine shop. Labs enclosed presumably to keep the dust